on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
These are common experiences. Jung knew it. I know it. And many, many people are now studying synchronicity, writing their own stories about them. I just keep hearing more and more from them that show us that our minds and our environments mirror each other. And if that happens, Nick, regularly, that suggests that our minds are embedded in our environments. And that's not the way we are taught to think about our reality. Right. Ancient cultures, indigenous cultures, tend to think that way, I am me because I am we, because we are part of this thing together. Mm-hmm. I am you and you are me. And the Beatles did something like that too with one of their songs. It's true.
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth. I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, I welcome Bernard Beitman back to the podcast to discuss his latest book, Life-Changing Synchronicities. Bernard broadens Carl Jung's concept of synchronicity to include experiences like serendipity, seriality, and simulpathy. We also discuss collective synchronicities and explore how these meaningful coincidences challenge the materialist worldview and might contribute to both individual and collective healing. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Bernard Beitman, MD, is the first psychiatrist since Carl Jung to systematize the study of coincidences. A graduate of Yale Medical School, he did his psychiatric residency at Stanford University. The former chair of psychiatry of the University of Missouri-Columbia Medical School for 17 years, he writes a blog for Psychology Today on coincidence and is the co-author of the award-winning book Learning Psychotherapy. He's also the author of Meaningful Coincidences. Bernard is also founder of the Coincidence Project. He joins me today to discuss his latest book, Life-Changing Synchronicities. Bernard, welcome back to Rebel Spirit Radio.
I'm rebelliously glad to be back here, Nick.
Well, I'm glad to speak with you again. I have a biting interest in synchronicities, and I enjoyed your
interest.
Yeah.
I heard that.
Yeah. I don't think I experience as many of them as you have, as you describe in your most recent book, which is different. I've read the Meaningful Coincidences, and that's what we spoke about the last time you were here. But your new book is, in a way, kind of autobiographical, because you're telling, in a sense, your life story with all of these synchronicities in them, and you're pulling very relevant information out of that. So, and I think that makes this a unique book. And I do want to say I found it a very enjoyable read and thought-provoking, as much as your other work has been. So I don't want to spend a lot of time on the basics, because we've talked about this before, and I think that most people have a general understanding of what a synchronicity is. But just as like real quick review, synchronicity is often referred to as a meaningful coincidence, but you also write that meaningful coincidence is a kind of an umbrella term that covers different types of meaningful coincidences. And I was just wondering if you could maybe just say a few very brief things about how you understand synchronicity and these meaningful coincidences before we get into the meat of what you're doing in the new book.
Well, thank you, Nick. It's a good idea. Jung used the word synchronicity primarily as an explanation for meaningful coincidences. He meant it as an acausal connecting principle, which means that two events that were not obviously causally explainable came together, and two incidents came out of nowhere and crossed each other, and there was no explanation. It was surprising, and it was meaningful to the person experiencing it. And that's what Jung meant by meaningful coincidence, which then it got merged with synchronicity. It's a great word. Synchronicity is a great word. So it became a synonym for meaningful coincidence. But there's a woo-woo kind of feeling around synchronicity because it's not very well defined, or there are multiple definitions, or people use the term in multiple ways. So I want to include serendipity with meaningful coincidences, because Jung would use serendipity as part of synchronicity in some of his writings. And in fact, the idea of serendipity came up in history well before Jung wrote about synchronicity. So serendipity tends to be a little more towards the scientific. It's a way people have categorized their Nobel Prize winning capacity. That's a lucky accident. A happy accident happened, and they boom, the maid put something on the stove that she shouldn't have in 1800s, and then boom, there was a new dye, and suddenly this guy got a Nobel Prize. The Nobel Prize winners tried to make good stories about how these things came around scientifically, and a sequence hypothesis, and then an experiment. But a lot of times, stuff just happened. The discovery of penicillin being the most accidentally well-known serendipity. So serendipity people, there's a serendipity society that tends to not think much about synchronicity, and synchronicity people tend not to think much about serendipity. The two of them overlap, but synchronicity tends to be more spiritual, psychological, and interpersonal, where serendipity tends to be more about finding ideas, things, or inventions in an accidental or surprising way. In addition, there's seriality. Paul Kammerer came up with that before Jung, 1919. His book about seriality was something Jung was well known to Jung, and helped inform some of his stories, including one about six different fish symbols that Jung experienced, or a dead fish and a couple other symbols, and six of them all in within a short period of time. And that's different from synchronicity, which tends to be a mental event connected to an objective event in the environment. Seriality is something you and I can see with Jung looking at these different fish symbols. So they're all objective, verifiable by somebody else. And the fourth one I've added just because I thought it needed to be there. Simulpathity is the term I invented, which means feeling the pain of a loved one at a distance. Identical twins do this pretty regularly, enough so that one twin said about the other twin, I wish Sammy would take better care of himself because I keep feeling his pain. So those are four different forms of meaningful coincidences. And what I'm trying to do to get a little towards more scientific about it is that they involve two basic elements: an objective event and a mental event. That's it. All of them, all these meaningful coincidences have those two elements as part of them. Sometimes it's a mental event matching a mental event, telepathy. Sometimes it's an objective event in seriality. And sometimes it's a mental event, an objective event, as in synchronicity and serendipity.
Okay. Wonderful. Thank you for that. I
Yeah, you're
appreciate that.
welcome.
And it brings up some really important questions. And as I was thinking this morning about how I wanted to approach talking to you regarding the book, I've got a few things I want to touch on. And not necessarily going over, I'm sure that we'll hit some of the synchronicities that have happened to you through your life and these patterns that you recognized. But just based on what you just said, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about is that synchronicity, more often than not, one of the objections kind of to it in a sense is that it's just coincidence, mere
It's just a
coincidence.
mere coincidence.
Yeah, and you wrote in the book that synchronicities can tell us something about the world and about kind of what's real. And I think that in conjunction with that is this aspect of you identified yourself in the book now as a recovering academic, and you had spent so much time you know, I mean, you know, in academia and psychiatry department, but also a neurology department. And there seems to be, and you talk about this in the book as well, that there's this materialist assumption that drives so much of our modern scientific explorations, but yet there are these things that are challenging that. So I was wondering if maybe a big loaded question here, you could talk about how these meaningful coincidences are challenging this sort of materialist worldview, and also are presenting a challenge to how academics study these things. What is it telling us about the world?
Yeah, thank you. It's a delight to know that you've read that book, both of them.
Yeah.
And life. I mean, nice talking to a philosophy religion guy. You've read it, and this life-changing synchronicity book that just came out is intended to be a model for what we're talking about, where a mental event matches an objective event. And it, because for readers, it's my autobiography told through coincidences. But it's intended to be a synchronicity for the reader, so that the reader can see his or her own experiences in my experiences. Because one of the key ideas about meaningful coincidences is that if a weird thing happened to you, it's also happening to somebody else right now, or will or has, that we're not that special. So part of what we learn from meaningful coincidences is our uniqueness is unique with us and maybe a subset of other people when it comes to some of these things. So that begins to challenge the way people think about things as myself. I am only myself. And one of the problems with Western thinking and scientism, as you're referring to, is that I'm an individual. I am separate. I am an island. I am me.
Yeah.
No, you're not. You are yourself. You have a sense of yourself, but you're also very connected to your environment. And Jung didn't want to bring synchronicity up until later in his life because he was afraid that he would be criticized for saying scientism, materialism, the mind is created by the brain kind of thinking, would get him criticized, that he would be laughed out of the academy for thinking this way. These are common experiences. Jung knew it. I know it. And many, many people are now studying synchronicity, writing their own stories about them. I just keep hearing more and more from them that show us that our minds and our environments mirror each other. And if that happens, Nick, regularly, that suggests that our minds are embedded in our environments. And that's not the way we are taught to think about our reality. Right. Ancient cultures, indigenous cultures, tend to think that way, I am me because I am we, because we are part of this thing together. Mm-hmm. I am you and you are me. And the Beatles did something like that too with one of their songs. It's true. We are both individuals and part of our context. And it's not just each other human beings. The terrible thing for scientists is that we're all part of our natural world too.
Yeah. 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 And, you know, it's not just scientists, I don't think. You know, coming from a background in philosophy and religious studies, I would also say that this is something that is not really examined from a perspective of humanities or social studies. You know, these meaningful coincidences, for example, in religion, I'm sure that they are there. The people are having these experiences, but yet they're very rarely examined. So it seems to be across the board in terms of academia that these things are somewhat ignored.
Oh, yes. Thank you for that, because there are many professors of religion who don't believe there's something greater than themselves. It's pretty remarkable, despite the fact that many religions seem to have been started by mystical experiences by the person who started that religion. It's a remarkable thing because scientism is part of our cultural way of thinking, which means we have to think this way in order to be accepted. It's a remarkable thing how we want acceptance by our social group. We need it. That's a human thing.
Yeah.
So that includes sharing the same belief. And no matter where you are in the ivory tower, that includes believing in scientism. That is our current religion in the Western world.
I was just going to ask, can you give a brief definition of scientism for anyone who may not know what that is?
It's the belief that you can know reality only by empirical studies, that you have to have data. You have to have data for anything to be true. To believe it, you can't trust intuition and you can't trust experiences of the divine or something greater than yourself as part of a way of knowing reality. It's only the scientific method that is useful and valid and reliable.
Okay, thank you for that. Yeah, it completely seems to disregard subjective experiences. But it seems to me that one of the things that you're trying to argue here is that, yes, synchronicities are subjective experiences, but there is an objective event, that it's not entirely a subjective thing.
You betcha. You betcha. The subjective is real too, ladies and gentlemen.
Right.
Subjective is real. I'm a doctor and I went to medical school. I got a lot of papers written as an academic. And the way I got started writing papers is by single case reports. So you get a single case and a weird thing happens. And then you find other cases that are like that one. Then you do a controlled study of those kinds of people. Then you do a placebo control study to see if there's the truth to the original observation. That's the way science has proceeded. And I'm not saying science is wrong here. The scientific method is a good way of proceeding.
Right.
And I'm trying to bring a scientific method to synchronicity. So if you get a lot of people telling you, and when asked the question, say, what is the most common coincidence that people seem to experience? And every time I ask that so far, the answer is thinking of someone you haven't heard from for quite a while, and they call you.
Yeah.
And I had to ask myself as a clinician and a scientist of phenomena that humans experience, just really, how common are these things? Because I knew they were, so I developed a valid and reliable scale according to the protocol of how you're supposed to do research in universities. And there's something valid about it, except when you get to some of the statistical questions, the statistician said, well, you can pick one of these four ways. What are you talking about? This is crazy. So there's a lot of subjective or guessing even among statisticians, but you don't know that until you get deep into it. It was surprising when I saw it. But this valid and reliable scale, the weird coincidence survey, which people can go to my website, coincider.com, or just put my name in and you'll get to the website and you'll find the weird coincidence survey and you can see how sensitive you are to coincidences. And one of the questions that in the survey is this thing about the telephones or contact.
Right.
And that's one of the most frequently, that happens most frequent, one of the most frequent synchronicities or coincidences people report. So when you see that happen, you got to say, if a lot of people have this happening, doctor, do we have an explanation for that? Because there's a lot of them. And so there's a collection, just like the single case reports I was talking about before, there's a collection of them. So maybe we ought to investigate how that happens. And Rupert Sheldrake did. And he could see that people could make pretty good guesses about who was calling them. And the guesses were better if they one of the people calling them was a relative.
Right. Yeah, I remember that research that he did. So, before kind of getting into some of the patterns that you've recognized, one of the things that you just said, and you have a term for it, but what you said is that the mind is embedded in the environment. And this is a very different view than our current understanding that mind is something that is simply a byproduct of brain. And the term you use, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but is the psychosphere. And that there seems to be, if I understand how you're using this, is that there's a greater realm of mind. You know, we have our individual, but there is something that extends beyond the individual. And so I wanted to ask, do I have that right? And is the psychosphere sort of where synchronicities or meaningful coincidences, is this where they're generated?
Yes, about both of the things you've said. The psychosphere I think of as our mental atmosphere. Another way to think about this is to consider the collective human mind. What about that? What do you think of the idea of the collective human mind, Nick?
Well, it seems like it's manifesting in terms of like the internet in many ways, but I think even beyond that, that there is more likely than not a kind of shared consciousness. I think that you mentioned Rupert Sheldrake, you know, that's one of his key ideas, I think, about the morphogenetic fields, right? It's like that once something's kind of once an idea is kind of out there, it's out there. I've seen it described, and I'm going to steal this from a movie, but there was, and I think there was a study done regarding this. It was like solving the Sunday New York Times crossword puzzles, that it seemed that people, if they were given it like a day or so later, but didn't know that that's what was going on, that they were solving it quicker and maybe even had a easier time at solving it, as if the answers were just kind of out there already, and that we could sort of tap into them.
Yeah, that's the morphic fields that Sheldrake is suggesting, that if you get one monkey learning how to peel a banana or open a nut, or these birds opening up milk bottles in England, the other birds learn how to do that faster. It's as if the information got out into this morphic field, and you could learn it faster. And it's got pretty good data to suggest that's there. That's true. My idea of the psychosphere includes morphic fields, but is well beyond them. But the idea that there's a field of shared knowledge, which the morphic fields indicate by the nice research that Sheldrake has done, is what I'm referring to as the collective human mind to begin with, that we share a kind of con we share consciousness, that we are part of one mind. And that one mind has, in the way I'm looking at it, three spheres that we are interacting with, that we give and we take from. We give information and energy out, and we take information and energy back from these fields. And you mentioned the internet as a start. One of the fields is called the noosphere. Teilhard de Chardin and others came up with this idea that has now been condensed down some to more scientific ways of sounding, because it's just easier to study. And it's about the internet, but it's also about all forms of communication, transportation, books, inventions, now artificial intelligence. This is the rational part of the greater mind, the noosphere. The psychosphere is the more emotional, intuitive part of this set of spheres that we have access to which we give information and take information and energy from. Akashic record is part, in what am I thinking, of the psychosphere, that is the record that of all human experiences in the past and currently, and could be connected to the morphic fields that Shudrake is talking about as they develop them. Through the psychosphere, we are connected to other minds, so that when I experience the choking that my father was experiencing 3,000 miles away, he was bleeding into his own throat, and I was choking uncontrollably 3,000 miles away from him around the same time. We were connected, and we're connected in ways that quantum physicists will call non-local, but you and I are now connected non-locally as well, Nick. I mean, the term non-local is so ambiguous that I prefer to be able to talk about it in more easily conceptualized terms than generalizing from photons and electrons at millions of miles apart. We are communicating through something, and that through something I'm calling the psychosphere. And once that gets understood and accepted, we can begin to then to develop a cartography, a map of the psychosphere, and how our collective human minds relate to both the noosphere and the psychosphere. And the third one, the third sphere that is so important for us not to forget, and we do, I'll call Gaia, or the Earth's consciousness. This Earth thing, I mean, these plants around me, I mean, I communicate with streams and trees and feel energy of them. I mean, you go out there and let yourself happen. It's good for you psychologically and emotionally to go out into the nature and hang around with trees and get to see how funny some of them are. They're like comedians with some of the ways they move their branches around and the wind. And then, you know, I was out there singing to these trees that I like, that I have a relationship with, one day, and I was like, put my hands out as I was being dramatic at the end of the song. And I put my hands out, and a leaf fell right into my hand right when I finished the song. So, I mean, you can call that, oh, that's just a coincidence. Weird stuff happens, and weird stuff does happen. In a large population, weird stuff happens, and you'll hear that from statisticians, and I'll agree with you. But then sometimes they can have meaning, and the meaning could be my connection with the trees and the trees' connection with me.
Yeah. I really enjoyed the aspect that you gave in this book about being in nature. And at one point, and I think this may be one of the principles you come up with, which was let nature open your mind, because that's also a challenge to this science, this materialistic scientism, is that there is no mind to nature.
Well, One of the fun and also frustrating things about what I'm doing here is I'm being out on the edge, and I'm not. Yeah. There's more people joining the synchronicity bandwagon and getting into it, but the idea that nature has no mind is laughable unless it's laughable if you have been out in nature and being able to talk with whoever you can talk with. I mean, these trees stopped me when I was walking along in the forest one day. How'd they stop me? I don't know, but I felt this nudge to turn around, and I started relating these two trees and then to a third one. Other people relate to different kinds of plants, to different animals. There's a guy who is an expert in trout and draws all kinds of pictures of these trout. He just likes that, somehow drawn to this fish, and he's gotten to know them very well. That's been true in ancient and indigenous populations before, that each of us has different talents. If we allow ourselves to connect with the sun and the moon and the trees and the rocks and the fungi. I mean, one of Sheldrake's son is doing fungus. He got a great book on fungus and how these things are operative in the world underneath us, in the ground, with their mycelia connecting the trees and the trees communicating with each other through them. There's so much activity going on under the ground that we don't pay attention to, and Sheldrake's son has brought the world's attention to them. And they're very funny, and nobody knows how they work. The funny thing to me about Sheldrake's son is in this book, he doesn't do anything in towards morphic resonance or morphic fields to suggest how these fungi communicate with each other. They're in a field and they communicate across the field, not just through neuronal activity, but he didn't get that. He doesn't put that in there. He's got to have it in his mind someplace.
Well, something that you just said prompted a question that I thought of, and this may go a little bit beyond what's in the book, but I don't think it's too far that you won't be able to give me a thought or an idea about this. But one of the things that you noted in the book is that, and this is obvious to everyone, or if anyone who looks, is that there's pattern repetition in nature. And you also identify pattern repetition and synchronicities. And I kind of want to jump back to that. And so maybe I'm going a little bit too far ahead. But the thought that I had when I was reading this was that on the other thing I want to bring in is that we, it's always said, the more you see synchronicities, the more you will see them. And at one point, you had even mentioned, and I don't know how much, is that we help to create meaningful coincidences. And so the question that I had was this, was that we seem to be disconnected from the patterns and the rhythms in nature. And so, like the changing of the seasons and, the many of the indigenous cultures or even, they weren't, or even in sort of modern forms of, like Wicca and some witchcraft, there's the celebration of following the moon and the cycles within nature. And so the question I had, I know a long-winded question was, do you think that putting ourselves back in connection to the rhythms and patterns in nature would also help us see more synchronicities, more meaningful coincidences?
I think so, and a lot of people will agree with you about that, getting into the flow of things. I go to dance pretty regularly, and a lot of times when there's a shift in from like spring to summer and the summer the solstices and the winter solstices, that we there's a celebration of them. So there's a lot of people who go with that flow. And when you're in a flow, you tend to have more synchronicities. I personally have not felt something to go with that particular way of thinking about, or that way of thinking about things. A lot of cultures, as you suggest, often do. However, you get into the flow. And what do we mean by flow? And flow, it's a lot of different meanings. The river flows, time flows, patterns flow. And I don't want to miss what you said about patterns being repeated, because it's fundamental to the way human beings operate in reality, is recognizing the need to recognize patterns. And you're describing a pattern. And the pattern that I'll go for is one that's related, evolutionary flow. And we try to understand, for example, what we mean by the word, the universe did it. People say a lot of times, oh, the universe made this happen, usually involving synchronicities when they try to come up with an explanation. And I've been puzzled by what people mean by that, when the universe did it. And it took me a while to come up with the idea of using the feeling of the energy going through the stem of a flower that powers the growth of the flower. Is just imagine for a moment what that energy might be. That energy that helps the flower grow, that makes the flower grow, is flowing through us as well as we each transform in our own lives. Yes, we get older, but we also can change. That flow is also in around us in Earth, as the Earth goes around the sun and the other planets of our solar system go around the sun, that our whole solar system is moving around at a rapid pace through our section of the universe. Everything is moving. Everything is moving. Even a rock is changing slowly over time. It's all process. It's not just stuck. You've got to keep moving. So the flow that we can get in touch with by being in nature, by connecting with the solstices, by connecting with what's going on around us, will increase the likelihood of meaningful coincidences. However, pattern recognition is fundamental. So if we talk about an explanation for meaningful coincidences, it starts with your own ability to put two patterns together and say, here's a pattern over here, and this resembles this other pattern, and they just happened a little while ago, these two things. So first you have to recognize a pattern, say, oh, that's something to see. Like, for example, I was asked to be on a Coast to Coast radio show because the I was substituting for somebody who couldn't be on. And then I have a patient come in right after I did the substitution who was playing the bass in a little band because the guy who was playing the bass had to go to see somebody in a relative in the hospital. As the person I was substituting had to take her child to the hospital. So here was my patient within 24 hours repeating the same pattern I did, where we each got to play in a band of some kind by the same pattern. We were mirroring each other, but I had to notice it. I had to notice his pattern, my pattern. I had to see the two patterns being similar. So our ability to notice patterns being similar, that makes us, that creates a synchronicity. If we don't see the patterns being repeated, no matter what kind of flow we might be in, there's no synchronicity. So my question for you, Nick, since you've read the book so nicely and so deeply, is what stories in my life-changing synchronicities, what stories were evoked in your own experience?
Okay, yeah, that's a good one. I actually have a really good example. And
Good.
there's actually two things. I know that I'm trying to be mindful of time here, but one was you at towards the end of the book, you were writing about this woman who was from the dance group that you participate with, who had sent out the message that she needed a place to stay. And so, out of the kindness of your heart, you let her stay with you, but she overstayed her welcome. And you wrote that as the energy in the house became increasingly negative, the washing machine overflowed, electrical power to the house was threatened, internet connectivity to the neighborhood went out. And what that brought up to me was this experience I had is that this was when I was living in California. I needed a roommate. And so I found a roommate through a former student of mine. And at first, everything was great, but then things just started falling apart. And I kind of felt bullied in my own house. But one of the first things that happened was I have this water crock. I would get bottled water, you know, these 5 gallons of bottled water. And I would hike every Friday, and I had just put on one of the 5 gallon bottle Crocs of water and filled up my water bottles and left. And when I came home, one of the first things I do is I want more water, and I noticed the bottle was all empty and the spigot on the crock was broken. And she had written a note for me that she had accidentally broken the spigot. I'm like, okay, well, that's no big deal. It was the 4th of July weekend. And so what I did is I just got on Amazon. I ordered another one. It was going to come, like on the 6th or 7th. And I figured, that's that. We got into a huge fight about it because she's like, where am I going to get my water? And I'm like, well, buy bottled water. And I had water pitchers with filters. And so there was water available. That just wasn't good enough for her. Things just started getting worse and worse. And then the kitchen sink exploded. And it was just water. I've got videos of it, that it was just water, water, water everywhere. And then when we finally had the end all be all argument, where I told her, I'm like, you need to find an elsewhere to be. About 5 hours later, I was out walking with my partner because I needed to let them know that I had asked this woman to leave. And I got a voice message from her that the water in her bathroom, she had her own bathroom, had just exploded all over everywhere. And so I noticed that water was this ongoing theme in this situation.
Oh, you noticed that.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
That
Oh
was
yeah.
hard to miss. That was hard to miss.
It was hard to miss. Yeah. Well, and it was funny because she eventually denied even having broken the water spigot. I'm like, but you put a note on the refrigerator that you did.
Well, thank you for that, because that's so similar
Yeah.
to my experience. The emotional overflow of my washing machine
Yeah.
and your sink are a parallel right here. And that's really what I've wonderfully wanted to, and my intent from the book is what you just were able to do. It
Yeah.
was a mirror for you, so you could laugh at me and
Yeah.
laugh at yourself at the same time.
Yeah.
That's really a. I mean, see, I wrote put this stuff out there, but I don't really know what it's going to do. And you
Right.
just told me what it's going to do.
Yeah.
So when you saw a story similar to your experience, very similar, really, how did that impact you?
I've always kind of followed synchronicities, and I always try to take, pay close attention to them. And as it was happening, it didn't shock me because I had had, and I can't really think off the top of my head of examples, but I have had similar situations where, especially like with water, that at really highly emotionally charged times, something happens with water. So it just, for me, was more of a validation that, oh, this happens to other people too. And along those lines, one of the other things I wanted to talk to you about was you gave me a term for it. And this was also with a former patient of yours. And you said that you had a patient who thinks in symbolic realism. And so I never had that kind of term. And so I think there's personal examples of this. The personal example was about, I don't know, 25 years ago, maybe even closer to 30 years ago. I had this idea of what would happen if I began looking at the world as if it were all a dream. And just as I would interpret a dream, maybe I should interpret all the things around me in my waking life as if it were a dream. I could not maintain that for very long because it was a little bit overwhelming. It was like a overwhelm of meaning, if you will. However, I still kind of think that way. And I think that way, not just individually, but culturally. And I've got an example for you that I think is very, very relevant. And that is the recent discovery by Harvard of that their copy of the Magna Carta is authentic. They thought it was just a cheap replica, but they discovered that it was authentic. And the first thing I thought of was, isn't that interesting that Harvard would discover that? And the Magna Carta is important because it's really kind of the foundation for our idea of habeas corpus. And right at the exact time that Harvard is being punished or attempted to be punished by the current administration, but also at the exact same time that they're floating around these ideas of suspending habeas corpus. And I saw that as a kind of collective synchronicity.
I really appreciate that, because in the book I'm writing now is about collective synchronicities.
Okay.
And it not just that, it's about how collective synchronicities can guide the collective human organism, humanity, into a better future.
Right.
Just like synchronicities can help individuals, the collective human organism, humanity, can also be guided by collective synchronicities like that. And so I've been trying to get a find some of those, and that is so cool.
Yeah.
That you bring that up. It's, you see the coincidence there.
Yeah.
Also the irony of it. What do you think that, if you're going to interpret that for humanity, that coincidence, what would you say it means?
I would say that it means that habeas corpus is important, that the laws are, you know, our concept of law is necessary, and that it's necessary in order to avoid kings and authoritarians and fascism. And we're at a point, not just in the United States where things are questionable, but other places as well. The other examples, I have a couple more along those lines, but one is because you had written in regards to that, that other things, you know, symbols can be handled like dreams, novels, plays, and movies. The other thing that came to my mind was the television version of The Handmaid's Tale. The book, The Handmaid's Tale, has been a touchstone for me for a very, very long time. I originally read it when it initially came out in paperback. But when the series was released, it was during the first Trump administration. And there seemed to be these odd echoes as to, or synchronicities as to what was going on in the show, as to what was happening in the nation. And I think the really good example was, I think it was the second season, where they had children being ripped away from parents. And we saw that at some of the borders where, you know, families were being separated. And I find it interesting now that this is the final season of that show. It took them a while to get this last season out. But what's going on now is the resistance. It is the fight back. And it's also, you know, what's embedded in that novel is a Christian nationalist takeover of the United States. And so it seems to me, and there's only two episodes left, so I have no idea how it's going to end, but that it's, there's something that's there within the, because all this was filmed before these happened. It's not that it's intentionally reflecting political events, but that the political events seem to be mirroring what's going on in this story.
The Titanic is one example that's similar, not as really profound, but still was a book called The Titan that came out 15 years before the sinking of the Titanic. And it described very much what happened. The ship and the number of lifeboats were pretty close, hit by an iceberg or hitting an iceberg. Yeah. The same story. So that sometimes the novelists are seeing the future. And it's a precognitive novel. Both of these are. This is more profound. Yeah. What other ones do you have besides these two, the Magna Carta?
Well, the other one that came to mind was, and I would have to think a little bit more about the details. I can just tell you that this is what I thought at the time, was that when Notre Dame burned, I was convinced that there was a greater message there. And especially in regards to, Our Lady, guy, I was connecting it to, I think there was, it was like particularly nasty hot summer in Europe due to climate change. And it seemed to me to be, if I remember my thinking correctly, what I thought at the time was, this is telling us that we need to pay attention to our mother, who is also burning right now.
Yeah, that's just the, that's, you are educating me about what I mean by symbolic realism.
Yeah. Well, it's just how I think. I don't know, but those are the three.
It's how you think. It's how you think, and it's pattern matching. It's being able to put two disparate patterns together. Don't worry too closely about the time. Okay. We can wrap it up in a nice way, but I have some extended, okay. But this idea of being able to see the messages in reality is what can make you crazy, as you were talking about. That's what happens when the filter goes down in people who are, some people who are psychotic. They start seeing too many coincidences and they want to interpret them and they can't. So they become perplexed, and that perplexity just makes their mind spin. And then you need an antipsychotic sometimes to slow their minds down. So you have to be careful, as you were indicating, it can be too much. So what you need is what I call a coincidence detection button in your head. When, like, you got to be sensitive, you got to train your mind to be sensitive to the ones that are most significant, those overlaps of coincidences, because you can make them up for a lot of different things going on around you. You can see too many of them. So how do you get ones that are salient, that are relevant to you or to what you're looking for? You have to have experience examining them and be able to have an intuitive button that goes off and says, pay attention to this one, Nick. And then you cannot have to bother with a lot of other ones.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, one of the things I think that sort of informs how I look at these things is the old Hermetic axiom of as above, so below. But I also always include as within, so without. And that seems to connect with kind of what you were talking about in terms of the psychosphere, in a sense, is because that's how I look at things like climate change, is that, and all the other environmental crises, is that that's a reflection on our inner state. And it's telling us we need to work on ourselves.
Hey, man, you got to see what I'm writing about.
Yeah, I'd love to.
Right now, because it's, you are informing me about what I'm writing about.
Yeah. Well, so I'm glad to be. I'm glad to be of help.
You are.
Yeah.
So we do need to wrap up a little bit, but as we get toward the end of this, let me try out this on you. You have a self-observer. Mm-hmm. I can tell. You can observe the goings-on in your own mind. Mm-hmm. And probably you do it a little too much sometimes. And it gets paralytic, as I could tell from your story of the water story in your house. You think and think and think, but you don't act. And finally, you got a way to act. So I can tell that you are aware of your own thinking. Mm-hmm. The self-observer has three functions: observing, analyzing, which you can do too much. That's an academic problem as well, because it's just what, or other people's problems too. But then there is the initiator or director, based on what the analysis is. So the self-observer has those three functions: observe objectively, analyze, and direct action. Well, they have to be in feedback loops with each other, educating each part of that triad. So I'm suggesting, this is what I want to ask you about, that we have the potential for a collective self-observer. That we have the potential to put together people like you who are good at observing their own minds and who also have an open heart are willing and wanting to love and be kind and connect with people, which you do, so that these individual self-observers can begin to coalesce and tell stories, as you did about the Notre Dame burning and other ones like that, so that we can begin to observe the patterns going on in the collective mind, particularly synchronicity ones, that tell us something about what we can do, just as individual synchronicities told me that this woman's got to get out of the house, and I was slow about it. I had to pay her to leave. Just, it was something like what you were doing. I learned from that one. And we learn from these things. What can we learn from these collective synchronicities and other patterns, other collective experiences, other maladaptive patterns of it, which I'm writing about now? And so, what do you think about this idea of a collective self-observer that can also analyze and direct action?
I think it's an interesting idea. I kind of want to ruminate on it. That's what I tend to do, is I ruminate on things.
Of
So
course.
it's always kind of difficult for me to give immediate responses sometimes with these kinds of questions.
Oh, go ahead, Nick. Give an immediate
But
response. Go ahead.
what does it does seem that we do need to have like a little bit of guidance somehow in terms of recognizing these collective synchronicities and what they mean, and what should we do about them? What should our action be? Because from my perspective, the messages seem pretty clear, but yet we're not really paying attention to them. We're not engaging in the necessary action. So, yeah, I don't know how what form the collective observer or would take. My guess is that it has to be something that it would emerge out of the collective, out of the many one.
Yeah, I don't know either. My thing is to be able to say, hey, baby, we need to develop this thing just like we have it for our own self. And what it looks like, it's going to be an aggregation of people with ability to observe their own minds, and then each with some different capacities that we pool. But then how it happens, it's almost like we don't know, because we never knew that AI was going to do what it's doing now. We don't know what this will do. And this is a balancing of the digital with the analog. This is using our analog thinking to then incorporate the digital instead of being overwhelmed by it, while we also scan our own collective mind for events like the ones you're describing. But I don't know. I can't tell you. I'm finding out now. I'm writing out now. I'm just writing about the collective self-observer right now. So it's a nice coincidence to be hearing you talk about it. And I don't know. I mean, all I know is that it's a good idea, and I'm getting bad ideas, I'll say. I don't know where they're coming from, but they're like, and I write this stuff down. I got up, as I told you at the beginning, I felt good this morning because I came up with this really good idea about the collective mind. And so, oh, you've answered my question. You would be a good collaborator potentially if you wanted, and whatever happened, I don't know, but the way you think makes you a potential participant in this collective self-observer. So I appreciate all of this today talking with you, Nick.
Well, I appreciate it too. And I guess, what I would say is that, I like Jung, and I do accept the idea of a collective unconscious. So if there's a collective unconscious, there's no reason why there wouldn't be a collective conscious.
Well, I don't like the collective unconscious so much anymore, because the unconscious of what? It's the unconscious of the collective mind. And then how do we think about this collective unconscious? Well, that's another story. We can get into that another time. But
Another
at
time.
least we know that there's got to be a collective consciousness too. And I'm playing around with whether to use those terms or not, but that's another thing. So
All right. Well, I appreciate this today, Bernard. And there are areas that we didn't go to, but this is a really good way to say, get the book, pick up Life-Changing Synchronicities, because there's a lot within it that we didn't get to in our conversation. But it's a great, fun read, and I think a very enlightening read, and can help people in terms of identifying more synchronicities and the patterns to them. And I think it can be very helpful. And I think, and this is one of the things I also appreciated, is that you noted that you thought that this could help us collectively heal ourselves in the world.
Yes.
Yeah. So let me ask you the final questions. I know you're working on a book that you've talked about. Is there anything else that you've got coming up? And I also wanted to ask, are you still doing the, what was it, the coincidence cafes?
We've suspended that for now. We've
Okay.
the coincidence project's going through a
Okay.
major transition, but people are still submitting stories to the Coincidence Project website. And if they want to get to the Coincidence Project website and put their story in and see what else we're doing, just put the coincidenceproject.net in your, all one word, except .net, the
Okay.
Coincidence Project, all one word, .net, and you'll get to it, as well as my own website, coincider.com,
Okay.
Coincider. But if you want to get to any of that, just put my name in the in your search engine,
Okay.
Biteman, and you'll find all of that. My
All right.
podcast and my Psychology Today blog.
Okay, wonderful, wonderful. Well, I will put links for the book and your personal website and the Coincidence Project website in the show notes and the video description.
Wonderful.
So Bernard, it was wonderful to reconnect with you this morning. I thoroughly enjoyed the conversation. I'm very grateful for it and grateful for the work that you're doing.
Thanks, Nick. It was a pleasure talking with you. It really was very enlightening.
Oh, well, good. I'm happy to hear that. And that's a wrap on episode 198 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you're part of my YouTube audience. As always, if you enjoyed this episode, please hit that like button if you're watching on YouTube, and don't forget to subscribe to the channel and click that notification bell. You can also follow Rebel Spirit Radio on whatever audio platform you use for listening to podcasts. Right now, I'm nearing 20,000 downloads on the audio platforms, yet I only have 12 followers, and one of those is me. It only takes a second to like, follow, or subscribe. It is totally free, and it really does help. Putting together this podcast is a labor of love, and I do love it. I put a lot of effort and time into each episode, so if you find value in the conversations I provide here, I hope you can find it in your heart to send a little love my way. With more subscriptions and followers, I could possibly get some sponsorship. And honestly, having some funds come my way to help with equipment, hosting, and other necessary subscriptions would be really helpful. You can also help by joining my Patreon at patreon.com/rebelspirit. The link is also in the episode description. You can also buy a super thanks on YouTube to help support my work. As I always like to say, I'm here in the Front Range now doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality, and ecology, consciousness, the esoteric, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's sacred relationship with the living earth. So if you feel moved by the rebel spirit, and you know I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to or watching Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be in peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your rebel spirit.